started. So this lecture is called Giving Grief a Shape, the Book of Lamentations and the Christian Life. And I want to start by using a quote from a fairly bizarre guy, this musician named Tom Waits. People know who Tom Waits is. He's an interesting, memorable guy. I'm going to give the quote, and then I'm sort of going to just let it sit with you. We'll come back to it a little bit later. But here's the quote. He says this: "The world is a hellish place, and bad writing is destroying the quality of our suffering. It cheapens and degrades the human experience." So that's Tom Waits, quite a memorable quote. I'll leave it up. Changing gears a little bit, in his recent book, Making Sense of God, Pastor Tim Keller comments that, and he's coming to this conclusion after working through a number of philosophers and cultural anthropologists' work, and he says this: Western societies are perhaps the worst societies in the history of the world at preparing people for suffering. Now, Keller is making a larger point about meaning and purpose in life. How do we find stability in our meaning? But I think it would be fair to kind of riff a little bit on what he's saying and say that perhaps Western societies are the worst societies in the history of the world at allowing people to express and do something with their suffering, with their grief. For various reasons, our culture in particular tends to swing to one of two poles when it comes to grief and suffering. On the one hand, grief makes us very uncomfortable, makes us very anxious, sort of threatens this narrative we've all imbibed that onward and upward, life is good, life is going to be great, and it makes us anxious. And so we suppress it, we deny it, we run away from it, we just sort of pull ourselves up by the bootstraps, suck it up, go right through it, don't acknowledge it. And then on the other hand, there's a propensity to make our grief, our suffering, our pain, our precious, and we hold on to it close, and we wallow in it, and we stay in it, and we never move through it. And I think these realities speak to the truth that grief in and of itself is very, very disorienting. It's very, very confusing. And on top of that, we haven't been given many good resources in our culture to know what to do with it. And one of the most common resources we've been given to deal with it is called it's the theory of the five stages of grief. People might have heard about this. I learned about this in a pastoral care class. And I'm going to gently critique it, because I think there's some issues with it. I think we have a lot to learn from this theory. It's associated with a woman named Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. You'll see a picture of her momentarily. There she is. That's great frames. But her theory, and this is it in a nutshell, is that grief works in stages. And these are the basic stages. At first, we deny that something bad has happened. It didn't happen. We deny it. From there, we move into anger. This shouldn't have happened. We're frustrated. We vent about it. From there, we bargain. We make deals to get through it, to do whatever, which leads to then depression, which is this fog of sort of sadness. And then it moves to the final place of acceptance. And so these are clearly five things that happen to people who are in grief. I think that's undeniable, but I think there's sort of some troubling aspects of it. The first of which, what was initially... Has anyone heard of this, by the way? Is this new? Or is this... I'm just curious. Okay, good. I think one of the things that's difficult about it is, or maybe problematic, is that what was initially descriptive of certain people's grief has now... It functions prescriptively. So people use these as plot points for their own grief. Okay, I'm in denial. That means soon I'm going to be angry. After being angry, I'm going to be bargaining. And what was meant to be descriptive functions prescriptively. I also think this leaves out a number of things that aren't in grief, aren't in the human experience of grief. There are these five things, but there's more. I think of haunting memories, the fact that people get triggered by things and return right back into grief. It's also worth noting that Kubler-Ross and many of her followers admit that the language of stages is actually artificial. Grief is not really this linear. It's not sort of this direct. It doesn't flow from one to the next to the next. But I think on the ground in popular literature that uses this stuff, that is sort of, that's the undercurrent. That's the truth it's trying to get you at. You move from this stage to the next stage to the next stage, and then eventually it's all behind you. But I think what's most peculiar or troubling about this is in these five stages of grief, there's not actually a place for grief. The closest it gets to grief is maybe depression, which I think just doesn't really name adequately what grief is. And so here's a quote that one theologian, this guy named Robin Perry, uses or opens his commentary on the Book of Lamentations with, and why in this sort of cultural moment that Tim Keller sees as one that doesn't give us things to deal with our grief, he says this, Robin Perry. Increasingly, we lack the social practices, words, and concepts necessary to grasp our pain by the horns and stare it in the face. We've been robbed of a vocabulary of grief, and we suffer for it. The Book of Lamentations accosts us by the wayside as a stranger who offers us an unasked for, unwanted, and yet priceless gift, the poetry of pain. We would be wise to pay attention. And that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to pay attention to the Book of Lamentations and talk about it and see maybe if it does offer us something in its poetry of pain. And if you know nothing about the Book of Lamentations, now you know it's at least poetry from this quote. And it's a collection of five poems that's in the Old Testament or the Hebrew Bible. And they're five poems that were written after the destruction of the city of Jerusalem in 586 at the hands of the Babylonian Empire, led by Nebuchadnezzar, who's this famous villain in the Old Testament. The bare bones of what happens in this fall of Jerusalem are recounted in 2 Kings. And even in the bare bones account, things are pretty rough. There's a 2-year siege on this city, which leads to a famine. So the Babylonians surround the city. Nobody can get out. Nobody can get in until the walls are breached. And this is after a two-year siege with the famine. Children are dying in the streets of hunger. And so the walls are breached, and the king tries to get away. He doesn't get away. He gets caught. This guy, the king, is named Zedekiah. His children, his five sons, are brought in front of him. And each son is murdered one by one right in front of him until his last son is murdered. And then his eyes are taken out. They gouge his eyes out. So the last thing he sees is all of his sons being murdered, and they take out his eyes. And then from there, the Babylonians take everyone from the city who's a skilled worker, a man, a priest, a soldier, and they're forced to march some 600 miles to Babylon. The city that's left behind is burned to the ground. The people are massacred. There's stories of rape, cannibalism, murder. The temple, the special place of God's presence in the city of Jerusalem, was plundered, it was destroyed, and all that was left behind were the poorest of the poor who were just left behind. And so these poems are a means by which those left behind brought their grief and their pain into expression. So that's sort of the context of the Book of Lamentations, and then this is where we're going to go tonight with it. Before we look at the book itself, I want to talk a little bit about how the book has been used in worship services, liturgical settings, in both the synagogue and the church. It's in the Old Testament, so it belongs to the scriptures of Christians and Jews. Then I want to look at the book's poetic, the way the book is shaped and how the poetry is set up, because I think if we're clued in onto the nature of the poetry, how the poetry works, we see part of its meaning. Form and content are deeply held together in the Book of Lamentations. And tragically, this is one of those places where if you haven't been shown this through a commentary or read it in Hebrew yourself, you completely miss the poetic of the book. So we'll look at the shape of the book, the meter, we'll look at the characters that show up in the book. From there, we're going to look at some central moments. There's five poems. We can't deal with all five poems. But we're going to start with the first poem, look at the third poem, as well as the fifth poem. And from there, we're sort of going to conclude. But before we go any further, I just want to say, if any of this interests you at all and you want to do a little more reading, I found these to be very helpful resources. This is this guy, Robin Perry. It's just called Lamentations. It's a commentary in the Two Horizons commentary series. This is a guy named Leslie Allen. I found this pretty slow going. This is pretty academic. This is a little less academic. It's a pastoral commentary on the Book of Lamentations. And then the final one is this Eugene Peterson, Five Smooth Stones for Pastoral Work. He has a really interesting chapter in there on the Book of Lamentations. And if you didn't know this about Eugene Peterson, he's famous for The Message, but he is a specialist in Semitic languages and the culture of the ancient Near East. So he's legit. He's got his credentials. But so first, starting to get into the book itself, looking at its liturgical setting, I want to talk about how it was used in ancient and contemporary worship contexts. Now, for many Protestant churches, Christian churches, one only ever hears a few words out of this book in the refrain of the hymn, "Great is Thy Faithfulness." It's a beautiful and treasured hymn of the church, but it's one that really doesn't acknowledge the devastating context in which these words were spoken, the context that I just described. And I don't think it's an exaggeration that this fits well with the overall culture of many evangelical churches, who've sort of mastered the art of avoiding sadness, not letting sadness into sight. And so this is summarized, this sort of culture is summarized a little hyperbolically, but I think effectively in the words of an Australian theologian named Benjamin Myers. And he says, "In the Protestant West today, smiling has become a moral imperative. The smile is regarded as the objective externalization of a well-ordered life. Sadness is a moral failure. Where evangelical churches theologize happiness and ritualize the smile, sad believers are spiritually ostracized. Sadness is the scarlet letter of the contemporary church, embroidered proof of a person's spiritual failure." So that's a pretty hard analysis, but I think there's some truth in it. And of course, in situations like this, the unexpected casualty is hope. Hope itself, because if life is just all smiles and giggles and rainbows and lollipops, what do you need hope for? There's nothing wrong with life. But we'll come back to hope a little bit later. Things are different, and I think potentially instructive, for us when we consider the Jewish use of this book in worship. And though the book is not read necessarily regularly throughout the year, it's read in a highly memorable and a prominent way annually at something that's called the Tisha B'Av. And that is Hebrew for the ninth of Av. Av is a month in the Jewish calendar. The ninth of Av this year will fall on August 1st by our calendar. And so on this day, this is the saddest day in the Jewish calendar annually. And so on this day, there are restrictions that the observant follow. They refrain from eating and drinking, unless they're sick or pregnant. They get an excuse then. But they don't wash, they don't bathe, they don't shave, they don't wear cosmetics, they don't apply any sort of moisturizing cream, they don't wear leather shoes, they don't have sex, even if they're married, and they don't study the Torah. Work, in the ordinary sense of the word, is restricted. And for the duration of the day, the observant attempt to refrain from smiling, from laughter, from idle conversation, and if they see other friends in the street, they don't greet one another. And it's also a day in which no one is allowed to be married. It's a day where you don't celebrate anything. And this day, Tisha B'Av, culminates with all of the observant going to the synagogue where the ark, which is the cabinet where the Torah is kept, the ark is draped in black, and it's covered, the Torah's in there, and the lights are down low, or completely off, except for a few candles. And they sit on the low, on either low stools, or sit on the floor, and they hear read aloud, in its brutal entirety, the Book of Lamentations. This day of mourning, Tisha B'Av, where they hear Lamentations read aloud, originated as a day to mourn and commemorate two of the saddest, most tragic events in the history of the Jewish people. The destruction of Solomon's temple by the Babylonians, which is what happened, which was the context out of which these poems were first written, we talked about a minute ago, as well as the destruction of the second temple by the Romans. Now, both of these catastrophic events, though separated by 656 years, are said to have happened in the month of Av, which is interesting. And throughout the years, the reasons for mourning, the reasons for coming and commemorating grief, have expanded beyond just the loss of these temples. And so it includes the First Crusade, which also happened in the month of Av, where 10,000 Jews were killed in the first month. The expulsion of the Jewish population from England in 1290, as well out of France in 1306, Spain in 1492, as well as the Holocaust. And Heinrich Himmler, who set in play the Great Solution, or the Final Solution, which is where the Nazi Party approved his plan to get the Holocaust going, where ultimately a third of the Jews in the world were murdered. That also happened in the month of Av. So as they listen to these public readings of these five poems, they bring with them not only their collective grief, the historical grief, but they bring their own as well, whatever is going on in their own lives. And so throughout the years, these poems of pain and sorrow, originating in the darkest moment in the Old Testament scriptures, they've developed this deep association with all that is wrong with the world, both collectively and individually. And so each year, the observant that go, their own sorrows, their own grief are swept up into the words, into the lament, into the tears and the cries of these five poems. And so these poems have come to not only express an ancient wound with the temples, but also live wounds, fresh wounds that they carry with them as they go. And so these poems could be understood as what the one scholar entitled his commentary. They could be understood as a liturgy of grief, a way that people could give shape and vocalize their grief, that thing that feels so disorienting. And so that's sort of the context of the book. I think it's a great way to get into it. This is a stone relief of the temple being ransacked and things being taken out. And this, I believe, says Tisha B'Av in Hebrew, but I'm pretty sure. So that's sort of the book. I want to look for a minute at the poetic of the book, because like I said, the form of the book is also part of its message. And it comes out of this moment of unbelievable pain, but it is this unbelievably and amazingly intricate poetry. And so if you'll bear with me, this is a chart that a highly skilled artist I know made. I made it. That's going to go through all five of the poems, just to sort of visualize in your head what's going on. And so this is the first poem. And so it has 66 lines and 22 stanzas. So each stanza is going to have three lines to it. And the beginning of each stanza begins with a letter of the alphabet. It's an acrostic. So it's a very complex way to organize the poem. The first poem deals with the grief and shame of Lady Zion. That's the personified city of Jerusalem. And if you move to the next poem, you see the same structure. This time it talks more about the fall of the city, the wrath of God. Again, 66 lines, 22 stanzas, and the acrostic, where the beginning of each stanza begins with the next letter. And ABC is not actually the Hebrew alphabet, but I thought it would sort of make sense that way for us. But then we get to the third poem of the book, and things get intensified. The acrostic is intensified, so that it keeps the 66 lines and stanzas. It's the same size, the same amount of shape, but each line begins with a letter of the alphabet. So it's like AAA, BBB, CCC. The acrostic is intensified. You can see how this is lost in many English translations. And then things change a bit when we get to the fourth poem, It has 44 lines, it keeps the acrostic pattern, 22 stanzas, but each stanza moves from 3 lines to 2 lines. So it's quite literally, it's 2/3 the size of the previous one. It's shorter. And in this one, they recount the 2-year siege, what was going on, and they contrast what was great about the city and now the current condition of the city. And the final poem actually drops the acrostic structure completely. There's no longer this order, this style. It retains 22 lines, 22 stanzas, but each stanza is just one line, and it just drops it. And again, no acrostic. And so this, the chart itself doesn't really get it, and will or doesn't always convey it. This is really highly stylized, intricate poetry. And it's a consensus among many scholars that the distinctions in form in 3 and 5 are meant to draw your attention there. Those are the major points of the collection's message. Now, apart from being really kind of cool, an acrostic takes a lot of work, takes a lot of time. What is an acrostic trying to convey, especially in Hebrew poetry? These aren't the only acrostics in the Hebrew Old Testament. Proverbs 31, which is about the virtuous woman, is famously an acrostic. There's a number of psalms that are as well. And I think there's two things that are trying to, at least two things, that are trying to be conveyed. The first is that the acrostic is a poetic form that's used to express the totality of something. Literally, the A to Z of something. Whatever is happening, it can fit in there. It is a careful and deliberate consideration of every detail of something, and in the case of Lamentations, grief. And it's a poetic device employed to take seriously its subject matter. And so here's a quote that gets at it from Eugene Peterson. He says, "The acrostic structure organizes grief patiently going over the ground, step by step, insisting on the significance of each detail of suffering. Arranged in the acrostic structure, the sufferer no longer obsesses, no longer controls. It makes certain that nothing is left out, but it also just as certainly puts limits upon the repetitions. If there is a beginning to evil, there is also an end to it." So these poems, and their acrostic structure, I'll just put it back here, are trying to express the A to Z, the Aleph to Tav of the human experience of grief and suffering. Grief is given deliberate and attentive space to be what it is. Whatever it is, however it comes out, it's going to find a safe place here. And so the second thing, and this is hinted at in Peterson's comment, is while the acrostic takes every aspect of one's grief seriously and with great care, it gently acknowledges that grief and pain, if they have a beginning, they have an ending. And there's no way to rush from the beginning to the ending. So it gives these poems a patient but inevitable movement to grief's end. And it does so over and over and over and over again before you get to the actual words of the community that's been left behind. In the fifth poem, the prayer. I said earlier, there's some ways we delegitimize people's grief, their suffering. We either downplay it, we deny it, we tell people to pull themselves up by the bootstraps and just get on with life, or we let people wallow in it, we let them just stay in it, and we don't speak hope into their situation. And so neither of these propensities are at work in the poems of Lamentation. The dominant acrostic form is in fact a safeguard against these two things. It's a reminder both that the God of the Bible is a God who takes our pain and our suffering with the uttermost seriousness and attention, but he's also a God who heals and brings an end to the pain. Eugene Peterson goes on to say, "Evil is not inexhaustible, it is not infinite," and I love this, "it is not worthy of a lifetime of attention." And it does so in this gentle, structural way. And then I want to talk about the meter. So this is brief, and maybe it's a little whatever, but meter is a unit of rhythm or a pattern that sort of keeps the poem going. And most Hebrew poetry has a 3-to-3 pattern, or meter. where the number of stressed syllables in both halves correspond to one another. But all throughout these first four poems that have the acrostic structure, that is not the meter that's used. The meter that's used is different. It's called the Kina meter, for those keeping track at home. But instead of being 3 and 3, it's 3 and 2. And so one scholar says that this has the effect that when it's read aloud, the meter produces a peculiar limping rhythm in which the second member, as it were, dies away and expires. You're sort of expecting something, the kind of completion of the poem, and it doesn't quite get there. It stops time and time again. And this works well, again, with the acrostic structures. It has the reader move through these poems slowly and deliberately. And so that meter, as well, also clues us into the genre. Though the book is called Lamentations, it's actually more... This meter goes with what's a dirge. And a dirge is a song that's sung at a funeral. So you could think of Lamentations as the funeral songs of the city of Jerusalem. Except the last poem. The last poem doesn't keep that meter. So anyway, that's acrostic structure, meter, character of voices. There's three people primarily that speak. You're going to have the man who speaks in the third poem. And in the third poem, he's giving his testimony in a way. We'll look at that a little bit later. And in the first, second, and fourth, he's more of a reporter. So in those, he's just giving his opinion, or he's reporting on situations. But in the third, he's giving his own perspective. So you have them. You'll have Lady Zion, who sort of personified this city of Jerusalem speaking. And then the last one, the congregation, the people that are left behind, which show up in the final poem. And it's interesting because you have these three voices in these poems, and there's one voice in particular whose absence is incredibly loud throughout the book. It's God. God doesn't speak in the Book of Lamentations. One Old Testament scholar, Christopher Wright, comments, though, that while heaven is silent, it doesn't mean that heaven is deaf or blind. So that's the structure of the book of Lamentations. It's meter, which clues us in onto the type of literature it is. These are funeral songs, except for the last poem, which is truly a lament that we'll see. And it's this incredibly... it's meticulously composed poetry. And that's what I wonder if someone like Tom Waits, who sees that so much bad writing makes suffering, demeans it and dehumanizes it. And I think the attention and the care in the composition of these poems shows that God cares deeply about human suffering and human grief. This is something I think Tom Waits might be looking for. So maybe I'll send this to him. I probably won't, let's be honest. So like I said, we're going to look now at three parts in the poems. We're going to get into it. And this is the opening poem. This is the first poem. This is just three lines. And I wanted to sort of be a little more intricate and kind of look at three lines because there's a density to this poem, these poems. There's a lot of imagery that works in these poems. And these poems consistently employ language from other parts of the Old Testament and do so, I think, in really, really amazing ways. So we're going to look at these three. This is the first three stanzas or three verses. And then we'll look at the third poem, which also is the central piece. We won't look as closely or as a detailed way. And then we'll look at the fifth poem, which is the lament. So I'm going to read it. How terrible that the city sits alone, once so great in population and size. It is turned into a widow, as it were, once so great compared to the other nations. The first lady of the provinces has turned into a forced laborer. She sobs and sobs in the nighttime. Tears rest on her cheeks. She has no comforter out of all her former allies. Her friends all have betrayed her, turning into her enemies. Judah was exiled after enduring affliction and hard labor. She now sits among other nations. She could find no resting place. She was constantly caught after being chased into tight corners. So this is a raw testimony of the experience of grief. It's a report on the condition of the personified city of Jerusalem, Lady Zion. She speaks up a little bit later. Again, the style is the dirge. This is a funeral song. And it's interesting. So this first couple words here, how terrible that. This is a translation from Leslie Allen. Most translations just say how. But the word itself that opens the book is this Hebrew word echa. And it's actually one of the two names of the book in Hebrew. It's either echa or it's the word that means dirges. Even though it's often translated how, they'll say like how the city sits. It misses kind of the depth. The word presupposes a contrast of realities, a grim present with a bright past. One scholar talks about how there is a chasm of bereavement that has been created between the past and the present, and it sets a tone for all that follows. But the word itself isn't totally a word. It's more of a cry. It's this primal cry of agony. And it's captured, I think, vividly in the words of a contemporary author, this woman named Anne Hood, in her book Comfort, A Journey Through Grief. It's a memoir where she's recounting the death and or the pain of living after her daughter's death. She writes about a scream of grief, this scream, this primal scream, that I think captures how this book starts, this word echa. She says, it's not the kind of scream that comes from fright, but the kind that comes from the deepest grief imaginable. It's a scream that comes when there aren't words to express what you feel. It's a scream that rails against logic and fate and everything that there is. And this is where it starts. This is where the book starts, with this scream, this yelling. And it moves from there to talk about how she's sitting alone. Lady Zion is sitting alone, and alone as a widow. Being a widow is sad, one, because you've lost your partner or your spouse, but it's also, it carries a cultural connotation in the ancient world. Widows were socially destitute. They had no legal or financial provisions for them. They were basically, unless someone was kind enough and generous enough to take them in, they were left out to be done. And so this great city has turned into a widow. The first lady, a queen. If we move to the second stanza, she sobs and she sobs in the nighttime. Tears rest on her cheek. She has no comforter out of all of her former allies. Her friends all have betrayed her, turning into her enemies. I find this a very visual verse, a very visual image of what grief is like, sitting alone with tears. It brings to mind the words of other mourners throughout history who've talked about tears. St. Augustine, in his famous book, The Confessions, his biography, he's speaking of the death of a close friend, and he doesn't even name the close friend. It's almost like saying the name is too much for him. But he says this. He says, "The tears, they stream down, and I let them flow as freely as they would, making of them a pillow for my heart. And on them it rested." Or the words of a contemporary philosopher, Nicholas Walterstorff, whose son tragically died in a climbing accident, and he wrote a book of reflections on it called Lament for a Son. And he says this, he says, "I shall look at the world through tears. Perhaps I shall see things that dried-eyed I could not." And so it might sound pious or trite, but the Bible teaches over and over and over again that God cares about tears. God cares about people who are in grief. And he's not embarrassed by grief, and you don't have to get your crap together and stop crying and then come towards God. But you come as you are. There's a dignity that's bestowed on tears here. Tim Keller writes that suffering people need to be able to weep and pour out their hearts, and not to immediately be shut down by being told what they should be doing. He goes on to say, nor should we do that to ourselves if we're grieving. There's also a significant word that shows up a couple times in this stanza, the word all. All of her former allies, her friends, all have betrayed her. And if you keep reading in the book, you'll hear all of her enemies, all of her people, all who pass her by, all of her glory, all of her precious things, all. This word all comes up, and I think it gives credence to the experience that many people in grief have, that all of it's an all-encompassing reality. It touches on everything in life. It can't stay in one hermetically sealed part of us, but it spills over. And this reality that she has no comforter in particular, no one to comfort her in her pain, shows up again and again in these poems. And one commentator calls that refrain the somber drumbeat of the collection. So it accentuates the experience of isolation and the singularity of grief. In the ancient Near East, we like to have people give us space often when we grieve in our culture. Give them their space, let them do their thing. But in the ancient Near East, it was custom for friends, for neighbors, for relatives, for people to come and mourn with you and to be with you in your pain. And here, there's no one to do that for her. For Lady Zion, she's alone. Now, the third stanza is in some ways quite a difficult stanza, but it's full of imagery from other parts of the Old Testament. So this language of affliction and hard labor, Judah was exiled after affliction and hard labor. Those are very memorable words in the imagination of people in the old of Israelites. They're words that don't show up much in the Old Testament, but they're words that described the enslavement of the Israelites in Egypt. They suffered affliction and they had hard labor. And so this verse, the beginning line of this stanza, is sort of saying what the experience of the exile is, the undoing of the Exodus, God's great act of salvation. The experience of grief, what's happened to them, feels like it's all been undone. All of the things that God has done have been turned on their heads. And then if we go down a little farther, it says she rests. She now sits among the nations. She could find no resting place. The language of no resting places in quotes. But those are well-known parts of the covenantal arrangement between Yahweh and his people that's recounted in the book of Deuteronomy, where if you disobey, if you obey, you get to keep this land. If you disobey, you're going to lose the land, and you're going to sit among other nations, and you're going to find no rest among those nations. So this is bringing all of that language, all of that reality back in the experience of their suffering. Now, it's worth taking a moment and saying the idea of judgment, of God's judgment, God's wrath, is all throughout these poems. But it's worth saying, too, these are poems. These are not theological treatises on why God judges who and when and for what reasons and to what extent. These are poems that give shape and express grief. There's lots of questions asked in Lamentations, but why this happened is never asked, which is, I think, quite telling. So if someone uses something from Lamentations, or you use it for yourself, someone uses these, kind of bludgeons you, saying, God's judging you, your pain and your suffering is the result of your sin, or this, that, or the other. There's some truth in that, but taking it from the book of Lamentations is exegetically, it's theologically, it's pastorally, just completely inappropriate, and it's a failure to understand what these books are trying to do. These books are a meticulously crafted expression of suffering and guilt, of grief, not an explanation of why God punishes people or what God's judgment looks like. One scholar calls these books a house of sorrow and a school for compassion. Though the people left behind are profoundly aware of their own guilt, the poems present them in a manner that should inspire us to compassion and sympathy, teach us to be good listeners. You can see that even in the image of the widow. And again, these are just the first three lines. It gets darker. I'm not going to spend as much time looking in depth at other verses or other sections of the book. But from here, I want to go to poem 3. If you remember poem 3 from this chart. So before, it has just been a reporting on what was going on in the city. But in the third poem, the man who did the reporting now speaks. And he gives his take on things. So we hear a similar voice, but in a new key. And again, this is an intensified acrostic pattern in this poem. And so it means what happens here is central to the message of the book. And what's interesting is as it is sort of this rhetorical climax to the first books, the first two poems, it slowly and gently progresses the idea. It moves things forward a little bit. And a way to understand the book, this poem, I think, to use very churchy words, is he starts by giving his testimony. He tells his story. From there, he delivers a sermon. He starts preaching. And at the end, he has a bit of an altar call, which actually doesn't get realized until the final poem and in a perhaps unexpected way. But I'm just going to read from Lamentations. I'm going to read his testimony. This is him articulating his own grief. He says this: I am the man who has seen affliction by the rod of the Lord's wrath. He has driven me away and made me walk in darkness rather than light. Indeed, he has turned his hand against me again and again all day long. He has besieged me and surrounded me with bitterness and hardship. He's made me dwell in darkness like those long dead. He's walled me in so I can't escape. He's weighed me down with heavy chains. Even when I call or cry for help, he shuts out my prayer. Like a bear lying in wait, like a lion in hiding, he dragged me from the path and mangled me and left me without help. He drew his bow and made me the target for his arrows. He pierced my heart with the arrows from his quiver. I became a laughingstock of all my people. They mock me with song all day long. He's filled me with bitter herbs, and he's given me gall to drink. He's broken my teeth with gravel. He's trampled me in the dust. I have been deprived of peace, and I've forgotten what prosperity looks like. And there's actually more, and that was just a selection of it. But there is an intensity here, and he has shared the same fate as the people. He knows the same type of suffering, the same type of grief. And if you're familiar with the Old Testament, this man speaks in a highly evocative way, but he does so by ransacking the dictionaries of lament in the Old Testament. So he's using language from the Psalms, he's using language from Job, he's using language from Isaiah, and he's re-employing this traditional scriptural language to describe his own experience of grief, which is really vivid and really intense. But he uses these not just to say how much he suffered. These are sort of his counseling credentials. This is what gives him the ability to say what he's about to say to the people. He's lived through the most horrendous experience that any of them have lived with, and he has something to say. But he doesn't start with his message first. We know the hymn, "Great is thy faithfulness," but we don't always hear. These are the words that come before it. And he's talking about his own pain, and he's using them as his counseling credentials, as his reason why he's worth listening to. And it's analogous to the experience of a pastor who had to speak at his own son's funeral, a pastor named Joe Eddington, who says this: I have been to where life hurts the worst and cuts the deepest and hits the hardest. Therefore, please listen to me. And this is what the man in chapter 3 is doing by giving his testimony to the congregation. These are not just pious words coming from a place of affluence and comfortability. These are coming from someone whose teeth have been broken with gravel, who's been trampled in the dust. But he says this. This is where he gets into his sermon. So he's given his testimony. Now he starts preaching. He says about all of this pain. This is moving down a number of verses. I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. And it moves on some more of this. And this is actually the center of the poem. If you look at the poem, the way it's composed, these words are the center of the poem, the centerpiece of the book in many ways. It says, for no one is cast off by the Lord forever. Though he brings grief, he will show compassion. So great is his unfailing love. For he does not afflict from his heart. That is the center of the book of his poem, of his sermon. And from there, he does a bit of an altar call. He calls the people. If this is true about God, this is true about our experience of grief, return to God. And he calls them to pray. And if you remember, I should have put this up a little more. If you remember this, So this is him. So he gives his testimony, he gives a sermon, and then he gives an altar call. He calls the people to return. The next poem, they don't return. It goes back to the acrostic, and it goes, it kind of compares and contrasts what was and what now is in the city, and the horror of the 2-year siege. But then we come to the fifth poem, the concluding poem, the shortest poem in the whole collection, and it's the only poem that's a prayer. So the people listen to the words of this man, this one who knows suffering. And again, this poem is stylistically very different. If you remember, it drops the acrostic pattern, though it retains the same number of stanzas. So it has that token of continuity to it. But it also drops the dirge meter, so it feels different. And Leslie Allen, an Old Testament scholar, says, the dirge style served them well by permitting full exploration of their grief. It enabled them to own their catastrophic experience and let the horror of it all sink in. Yet the new format, the lament, still gives them room to vent their grief. But in this context, it enables them to take to heart the testifying preaching of the third poem by tentatively venturing into the new territory of hope. So this poem, the first extended prayer in the book, finally, it realizes the goal that the other poems have been working and building towards, which is prayer. I think dropping the acrostic pattern and entering into prayer signals something of a crack in the totality of grief and characterizes the previous poems that characterized the previous poem, and it sort of cautiously contemplates opening itself up to hope. But this is what it sounds like. This is what the lament sounds like. It says, remember, Lord, what has happened to us. Look and see our disgrace. Our inheritance has been turned over to strangers, our homes to foreigners. We've become fatherless and our mothers are widows. We must buy the water we drink and our wood can be had only at a price. Those who pursue us are at our heels. We are weary and find no rest. Slaves rule over us, and there's no one to free us from their hands. We get our bread at the risk of our own lives because of the swords in the desert. Our skin is as hot as an oven. We're feverish from hunger. Women have been violated in Zion and virgins in the town of Judah. Princes have been hung up by their hands. Elders are shown no respect. Young men toil at the millstones. Boys stagger under the loads of wood. The elders are gone from the city gate, and the young men have stopped their music. Joy is gone from our hearts. Our dancing has turned to mourning. The crown has fallen from our head. Woe to us, for we have sinned. Because of this, our hearts are faint. Because of these things, our eyes grow dim, for Mount Zion, which lies desolate, with jackals prowling all over it. You, Lord, reign forever. Your throne endures from generation to generation. Why do you always forget us? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to yourself, Lord, that we may return. Renew our days as of old. Unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond all measure. That's the end of the book. It's the end of the poem. The poem doesn't end with the closure we might hope for, but it ends with a question. Psychological, spiritual closure for these people is going to happen outside the confines of these poems. But I think this culminating poem's goals are much less lofty than closure, but perhaps are more daring. This prayer of lament is an attempt to make contact with God from the place of grief. Having given grief space and attention and care, the care it deserves, this book closes by offering us a prayer of lament. This is the only lament, really, in the Book of Lamentations. The others are these funeral songs. And so, having worked through their grief, their pain, from A to Z, having expressed it, they bring their grief before God. And in a prayer of lament, you protest. You say, things are not the way they're supposed to be. One theologian, John Swinton, talking about lament, he says, by learning the practice of lament, we become the type of people who take seriously the pain and sadness of the world, but refuse to be crushed by it. And this book ends with a profound sense of ambiguity and resists a neat and simple, tidy package. And in fact, the Jewish festival that I talked about earlier, the Tisha B'Av, at the closing, they don't actually end with the final verse, where it says, unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond measure. They go back and repeat the verse before it, which says, restore us to yourself, Lord, that we may return. Renew our days as of old. So hope has entered into the reality of grief and pain, but it's a hope that takes seriously their condition, the condition of the world, and the reality of their own grief. And that's where the poem ends. It's not where the Bible ends. It's not the final word on grief or on hope. In fact, there's at least one Jewish tradition that says, that believes the Messiah will be born on the 9th of Av, on this day, which is the day of the most sorrow and grief that these people have. And there's more that could be said, but I sort of want to respect the way the book ends. Grief in our own lives often doesn't end in a neat and tidy way. And that's mirrored here in this lament psalm. It ends with this question. Why do you forget us forever? Why do you forsake us so long? Restore us to yourself, Lord, that we may return. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and are angry with us beyond measure. I am going to stop there for now. And what we do here is we take questions for as long as anyone would like to talk about anything. I'd be happy to also go a little further about why this isn't the final word that the Bible has on grief. But I just wanted to respect, I think there's something very comforting and very human about the way the book ends. Because it reflects the reality, I think, that most of our lives have with grief. So the floor is anybody's, if anybody wants to say anything, or share anything, or anyway, the floor is open. And you can, if you need to leave, feel free to leave. And if you need a Nanaimo bar, I understand. I actually brought one. So.
Mm-hmm. I'm just looking in Scripture. Lamentations is in between the book of Jeremiah and the book of Ezekiel. Do you have a sense at all of kind of why it's placed where it's placed?
So that's where it's placed in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And it's because traditionally, so that means like up to the Enlightenment, the belief was that these were the words of Jeremiah, the prayers of Jeremiah. And then critical scholarship came in and said, well, of course it can't be Jeremiah, because people have always thought that, and we're German higher critics, and we have to, you know, get rid of all of those sort of things. But there's actually been some interesting work. That guy, Perry, has done a lot of interesting comparing of vocabulary and sort of how ideas flow. And he thinks it's pretty reasonable to think maybe Jeremiah wrote it or had something to do with the composition of the book. But it's placed there because of that. In the Hebrew Old Testament, it's placed in what's called Megillah, I believe, which is the five small scrolls. So, which is Song of Solomon, Esther, Ruth, Lamentations, and Ecclesiastes. And those are all read at annual festivals, or so, and that's why they're called like the five little festival scrolls. But anyway, that's why it's placed there in the English Bible, and it has a different placement in the Hebrew Bible. Liz.
What do you think are some practical ways that we can help people as friends of someone who's suffering to stay in the grief for the time that we need, and just to be sensitive to the time that we need, as well as helping them move through it with the appropriate timing? Be aware of that.
Yeah, I don't know if I have any hard and fast rules, but I... I think I find the nature of these poems holds both that we need to take grief seriously and however it comes, but we also like that Eugene Peterson quote says, if it has a beginning, it has an end, and we'd be bad friends if we never found ways to instill hope. But you know, the way this book works is you go through the alphabet four times of grief before you even get to that communal lament, that bit of hope, that sliver of hope. And the hope is just that it's a prayer, that it's bringing all this to God. It's not a very hopeful or particularly hopeful prayer. I don't know. I'd be really curious to hear from other people who've had more experience or whatever. I sometimes think it's a case by case thing, and as you get to know someone and their grief, I think it's maybe easier to see when it's wallowing and when it's denying. And I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
I don't know. I'm asking if they really want to know.
Yeah.
But I do think sometimes. I guess.
Maybe not saying that right away.
Yeah.
You know, that in that, I had one quote from Tim Keller in there about letting people and yourself kind of cry when you need to cry. And he had recounted a story somewhere right around that in the book about a guy who was mourning, and someone came and sat next to him and told him everything that he knew was true about God and everything he knew that was true about, I think, his son that was there. And he was just I couldn't wait for the person to leave. I just didn't want to hear it. And then he said, not long after that guy left, someone just came and sat next to him in silence and said nothing. And he just did not want that person to leave. And when that person left, he wanted that presence back. So, I mean, that's just one instance, but anyway.
That reminds me of the story that my colleague at the Grief Park told about sitting down with someone who was going through deep grief, and she just cried and cried and cried, and he just sat there and he didn't have anything to say for a long time. And after it was done, she was just you're the first person who's ever just not said anything and just sat there, and she was so thankful for that.
How do you know it's not as simple as, you know, five stages. I'm probably never going to write. You know, how do you, I get stuck.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, just sort of riffing off of just this particular, you know, expression of grief, which isn't, you know, there's not like hard and fast rules to it. But I think taking it seriously is a huge thing. And legitimizing it. But also, again, I'm just using kind of the imagery from here, admitting if there's a beginning, there has to be some sort of end, and maybe that end doesn't look like it's all gone, it'll never be triggered and sort of come back. You know, I think ideas of closure can be pretty cruel. I think taking it as it comes, but knowing there's sort of the movement through it. I think having friends is very vital to this, and yeah. Does anyone else have any? Yeah,
yeah. Just, I mentioned this before. I think about a pastor talking about Psalm 23. You know, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And it's not only, it's really translated a little bit differently now, but it just makes a big point of we're walking through it. We're not making our home there, we're not pitching a tent there. Something very biblical about that, about moving through it. It's even emphasizing that as you go along here, but I think that his expectation is that we're on the move. I was just reading in Isaiah 43. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. Through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. And you walk through the, when you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame will not consume. Those are the ultimate threats. Water to drown you, mass fire to burn you. You're walking through. You're not sticking around there.
No.
But even there, God takes you through it. And for I'm the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. And somehow, the moving through it has got to be, you know, the day comes and the day goes. There's another day, the next day. And there's hope in that even. I think if we attach ourselves to the idea that this is something to move through, this is not a fixed place, which of course, if we're really depressed, that's a major challenge to believe is possible.
Mm-hmm.
How could anything possibly change?
Mm-hmm.
It's surely going to be this way forever and ever. But to know that God's program is in motion, God's program is historical, unfolding, a story, it's a process. And I think that's got to be somehow holding on to that. It's got to be something to grab all the way up high and not sort of sink down and pitch our tent in the valley of the
Yeah.
And also, like in Isaiah, the famous chapter says that Jesus is queen of the tree. So, like, he knows what we're feeling, even more than, like, his grief was so much greater than our grief, because he grieved the sin of the whole world, and our grief is just a personal thing. So, like, in some ways, he knows exactly that cry, or that scream, or that feeling, or that depression, or that loneliness, and so, just crying and saying, you know, I don't know what to say, and I just need to cry with you and on you and next to you, God. And like, sometimes that happens for me, even if it's not like grieving for a person, if it's just like feeling afraid or confused about something, I'll just start crying. I'm like, I can't pray right now, so I'm crying. And then I just get this feeling of peace, and it's like, it's okay, you can just cry, it's fine. And he waits when I'm crying, and usually then I read something that comes to mind, and it's like the perfect thing that I need to cry because you wouldn't cry and didn't say anything. So sometimes you just let God be your silent friend. He makes out a new person.
I wouldn't want to disagree with what you're saying about Jesus. I think that's incredibly important, and there's actually quite a really fascinating kind of verbal link between those chapters in Isaiah and the language of the man in chapter 3. But I think at the same time, I think it's not always wise or helpful to always compare our grief to someone else's grief and say, well, this person had more, this person had less. And I don't see Jesus doing that with sin. I've taken everyone's sin on me, I think those can be very, it has to be a hopeful thing that Jesus feels our grief as well, and he knows what it's like, but he's not going to then say, by the way, I also know this person's grief, so get over it. I think he wants to... I think some of those compare and contrast can be helpful at certain points, but especially when people are still in grief, can be kind of debilitating, or it can minimize something that I think is really real. Did you have your hand up?
Yeah. I guess I was going to say, I feel like a part of not getting stuck in the grief, and I guess to me, part of the power of Lamentations is just the fact that it's there, and there can be an outlet and a way to express grief, and not just, in other religious systems, say for example, Islam, it's like, inshallah, everything is dual wallah. In a sense, there's no space to, even express it and give it a shape. And then I also think, there's an interesting link, I feel like, in what's happening in our culture today with identity politics, where on the one hand, some people say, get over it, and there's not a way to actually express the, I'd say, victimization that you felt, that you experienced. But then on the other hand, if you make that your like dominant identity, then there's no way of, it's almost like if there's a beginning and an end to it, then who am I like after I come through it? There's almost like there's no space to be hopeful, because that's almost like I've decided to make this a part of who I am. So it's almost like debilitating, and so it's like from that place of victimization, I have to fight everything and everyone, because I'm essentially kind of trying to fight to hold on to this part of my identity. So in my mind, it's almost the fact that I can give it a shape, and I'd be interested to hear kind of the end of that hope, because it's almost like, as I give it a shape to help me move through it, it's in a sense, I have to have somewhere to lift up my eyes to, right? And I think that being there as well, it's almost, it doesn't give it a time, like, it's going to be 3 weeks or a year, but it's almost like I need to know that it's there. So, I don't know. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was interested, Joshua, how do you think, I was intrigued with the quote you had on earlier, that it's kind of, it's spiritual to smile.
Oh, yeah.
Smiling
yeah.
is kind of orthodoxy.
Yeah.
And you really can't not smile or be expected to be expected as a Christian. What out here? How does that world relate to this, do you think? Where is the connection? I want to say, hey, read this, read Lamentations, but do you think that the book of Lamentations will challenge that sort of person? Or, I don't know, how do you see them interacting? I was trying to think of how this, as you went along, how that sort of person is going to receive this.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, the book of Job and some of the Psalms and a bunch of other stuff.
The hard parts.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a good question. I wonder if some people will be relieved, you know? Like, I think... I work at LaBrie, whatever. I often hate going to church. Like, I don't want to go. Sundays are less now than other seasons of our life, but I have just not wanted to go to church. And church has been a very hard place for me for different reasons. And not all because I have this real sorrow that I can't express. It's been other things. But I wonder if some people might find it a relief. I don't know. There's this... I'm not sure if this exactly touches down. There's a guy who teaches at North Park Seminary, I think, in Chicago, named Sung Chan Ra, I think is what his name is. Do people know who he is? Yeah, and... but he actually, before he was a professor, he planted a church in Cambridge. And they decided that the first sermon series they were going to preach is the Book of Lamentations, which he thought was for sure going to, you know, keep this group of 15 people at a solid 15, you know, for the next, like, who's going to want to hear? Yeah. You know, like, it's not, no, who's going to want to come to this? And it's not as though the church, you know, went crazy, but people came and people wanted, were drawn to language and words that could say things are wrong with the world and I don't have to like it and I don't have to just deal with it and or pretend it's not there. So... So I wonder if some people will be relieved. I mean, I think there's, you know, any other number of ways that maybe not necessarily introducing this book, but some of the, like, is it Blue Monday? What is it? The service they used to have at Grandview? Is it Blue Monday?
It's not Blue Monday, but yeah, it's during Advent.
Blue Wednesday, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's just a service where you come, and there's at least the one in Vancouver, the church we went to, very short liturgy, which sort of shaped in scripture a few lament psalms. It ended on a more positive note than the Book of Lamentations. But you would just come, and if something happened that year that was painful, that was still with you, as you were waiting for... the Prince of Peace to come, you know, at Christmas, you brought places that weren't at peace in your own story, in your own life. And so people would bring pictures of family members who died and just talk. This is my grandfather. This is what I loved about him. And it was just a space to sort of say what needed to be said, to sort of, to pray, but to not, gosh, what does he say? It's so harsh. He says sadness is the scarlet letter of the contemporary church, embroidered proof of a person's spiritual failure. Like, this is just a time where you could be sad, and it was part of your spiritual life. It wasn't just. So I don't know. I mean, I just think you've got to be pretty. Pretty dense to not see things that are really wrong and messed up with the world, and that the trajectory is not that they're going to even themselves out, but that you know, there's some bad all over the world, and you know, however bad it is here, like, things are, and they are, things are really hard elsewhere too. And I'd read this book a number of times, and I sort of knew about some of this stuff, but I mean, I decided to do this lecture after watching drone footage of Aleppo, and just feeling like, you know, it's like little kids playing soccer in the midst of rubble, and it's like, this is not right. I don't know. Are you friends?
This is a little bit of just sort of like formulating out loud, but what Dick said about the 23rd Psalm, that idea of moving through it, I think because I'm preparing this lecture next week on Sabbath, I've been thinking about the idea of rhythms, and you and I talked about this a little bit today, like, you know, rhythms that were given, and I, when Dick was talking, I was thinking about liturgies within the church, and things like baptism and the Eucharist and Sabbath and these things that we revisit over and over and over and over again. And I don't know, this feels abstract to my head, so I don't know if it makes sense, but I feel like that's a way to move. That's a way to continue that forward movement, because it, you know, baptism takes us back to the covenant that God made with us that we broke, but that He was faithful. The Eucharist takes us back to the sacrifice of Christ and the hope that we have through Him, and the companionship we have in the body of Christ. You know, Sabbath takes us to a place of reminding us that all we have is from God and that He is our provider. And so I think there are ways that those types of liturgies can help keep us moving. And I think some of the contemporary church, and I don't want to hang all our hopes on liturgy. I don't go to a particularly liturgical church myself, but I think the contemporary church tends to be moving away from that. And I think much of postmodernism has seeped into the church as well. So there's this sense of like the self is the center and I have to carry the weight of things, where I have to find the meaning and the source of meaning. And so I think some of these things, and I think in particularly the liturgical churches that do read through, that do have a time of lament, you know, the prayers of the people and going through. And it's interesting, I have a good friend who attends a church, a very large church in Boston that I live in, that's not at all a liturgical church in any way. In fact, they've sort of intentionally eschewed a lot of that kind of stuff. And she was telling me that after the election, they, in one particular service, they had this time of lament. They'd never done that ever in the service. And at the time they had like post-it notes and people could write things. And she and then I knew two other people who go to that church on separate occasions all made comments to me of just how significant that was and how helpful that was and how meaningful it was to have this kind of tangible place to put these things, you know, within that church body and that church community. And I don't know. I'm just trying to put a lot of pieces together, but I just think there are some things within our life together that certain churches maybe do better than others, but it can keep us, you know, if we have a right view of those things, that can keep us on the move through the water and through the fire. Yeah. One other thing I was just going to say, sort of back to Nick's question, is I think this is C.S. Lewis. I don't actually know if it is. I always give him credit for it, but I think it's just the analogy of grief being like waves, like ocean waves, and this idea that we can sort of see a big wave coming and we can just turn and run for it, you know, just taking a lot of our effort to avoid it. And then we also can just feel like we're going to be pummeled by it. But just that idea that it comes and it goes and it comes and it goes. And to your point, it's not a straight line. And it comes and it recedes. And I think even just recognizing it for what it is can be a helpful way for us to sort of sit at the shoreline and let it cover us, and then let it go, versus sort of fighting it or fleeing it, or, you know.
Yeah, Nikki?
The Blue Christmas or the Blue Wednesday service at St. Mark's this year, there was only five of us. but it was so helpful to have words given to you. Mm-hmm. And we read through all the lessons, but at the end of each lesson, there was a prayer of lament and sorrow and grieving the loss of life, the loss of, I mean, all different things, the prayers for the people, for yourself. And then at the end of the service, you're invited to light a candle, and but then you put the candle in the ashes left from Ash Wednesday as a reminder of whatever the grief you are grieving, it is made right at the cross. And it was just such a beautiful reminder. And it was so simple. And you left in darkness, but just with lit candles.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had blankets of the church. Ladies had some and to take with you as a symbol of being covered in prayer and in your grief. And just a very beautiful, tangible way of being reminded that you are comforted. And the cross. And I just think that whenever you can do those things collectively, even with the five sweet people of St. Mark's, it's a very helpful reminder that your grief is made right, that all wrong will be made right.
Yeah.
I just have a comment. As far as like with like moving through grief, just in grieving, I think part of it is like when we like validating that grief, that emotion in the moment, and at the same time like speaking truth to, in that situation, like I am not alone. Like God is with me. Like, because sometimes grief or sadness can be very overwhelming, and you need to like feel that, I think, to move beyond it. And, but like, the Spirit, like Christ, meets us there, and He, I know in my life, He's, when I've done that, He. It says, I am with you. And, like, He's, like, the treasure that we take from that. And, like, we can focus on Him. Like, and He can help us in the right timing, which is very personal, to walk through it. And, but... I think what helps is that truth.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. And I think, like, even in Lamentations, like, when we feel that, like, He, yeah, just, like, He's our treasure. You know, I mean, He's in the end, like, that eternal perspective. Like, right here, this is temporary. But our home, if we're Christians, is heaven. And we're to fix our eyes on that. And He's with, I mean, the here on earth is just filled with pain. That's the norm. But it's with Christ. And we are to focus on Him. And He is the one that becomes our comfort. And in receiving how He comforts us, that's how we know how to comfort others.
Mm-hmm.
How did He comfort me? And that, it's kind of like, that's how we're able to, like, we receive comfort. Kind of like there's something in the Bible about we're able to comfort others with the comfort that we ourselves have received.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to be willing to feel that. And not be afraid to feel that.
Mm-hmm.
Because when we allow ourselves to feel it, He meets us there. Those who mourn will be comforted. And the Holy Spirit is the comforter. And then we get, it's that relationship.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Amen. Is there someone else? Danny? Have you ever heard of
me?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just thinking about the author of Lamentations working through his grief, and that it wasn't as though the author sat down and just scribbled this all out really fast. He obviously made this a work of art, and he really wrestled. He had to work through it. You know, it wasn't as it didn't just come. So I think someone who has an art, I guess I get annoyed with people who say art has to be uplifting all the time, because clearly this is art that is not uplifting, even though it has that grain of hope in it. And part of anyone's process of grief is really legitimizing it by looking at it very keenly, you know, and not just saying it exists in my life, but actually like looking at it with keen eyes and with the help of others.
Yeah, it's significant enough of a thing to pay attention to, or thank you. Melissa?
Yeah, I think it was in the fifth one, the prayer. It felt like the author almost was like in the sense of deserving, like and maybe I misheard it, but that this there was like this deservingness to the affliction. Like they had, like, I don't know, they had done something to cause it? What? I don't know if that's part of, I mean, is there legitimacy to that?
I mean, at one point they, where is it? I just pulled it up here. Woe to us, for we have sinned. Would that be?
Yeah, just kind of like
the line.
A couple lines in there.
Yeah.
I think that is really complex with grief of like blame or
I gave the little, I said a little word, I could probably say more about it, but I think the book isn't an explanation of why everything worked out the way it did. The book does come at the end. It's not as though the sin of the people of Israel was like a once-off thing and then God was like, you're done. Like, it is a 500-year history of continually walking away or straying or sinning, and God extending grace. Even how the third stanza brings back the covenantal language. Like, there was a deal that we had with God, and if we do this, this is what's going to happen. It's almost like this was part of the deal. But I think it's, again, the nature of what the book is as poetry, as not as explanation. Like, it wants to create sympathetic listeners. And it presents, even though it acknowledges guilt and sin, it gives all of these images of the city and of those left behind as people we have sympathy for. We don't stand over and say, well, look, God, you knew this was going to happen. Like, come on, buddy. Or it's designed in a way. I love what the one scholar called it. She calls it a... just want to get it. It's a A House of Sorrow and a School for Compassion. Her name's Kathleen O'Connor, and her commentary is called Lamentations and the Tears of the World. And she's actually, she's an Old Testament scholar. She has also written another book on Jeremiah and the exile. And she's done a lot with studying post-traumatic stress and anxiety. And connected it to Lamentations and Jeremiah in particular. Like I said, I think it would be really pastorally, it would be a failure of understanding the book for what it is to use it as a way to sort of bludgeon someone with, like, well, God's doing this to you because you messed up. I think that's not just a pastoral failure, but like an exegetical failure as well. But it's also, I mean, it's a book that takes place in a real world where people make decisions, and people are also, it doesn't sort of just downplay it and make them just victims. People have volition, and I forget if it's in the third, I think it's in the third stanza. There we go. It's a little bit later on, but there's all of these images of like what when it references or sort of echoes the language of Deuteronomy and the covenant, it's almost presented in a way where, yeah, I don't think it's in these, where it's like, okay, like, yes, we were going to be punished, but this has gone too far. Like, it's too much. And one of them is, talks about their children. I can't remember the exact words, so I don't want to say it. I actually think it really is in the next stanza. I was going to do 6 verses, but decided to just do 3. But yeah, is that an answer? Is that, do you want to, I had this quote, I decided not to read it for whatever reason, but from, just talking about judgment in the Old Testament. This is from a pretty well-known Jewish theologian, Abraham Joshua Heschel. He says, God's concern is the prerequisite and source of his anger. It is because he cares for people that his anger may be kindled against them. God is moved and affected by what happens in the world and reacts accordingly. Events and human actions arouse in him joy or sorrow, pleasure and wrath. He's not conceived as judging the world in detachment. He reacts in an intimate and subjective manner and thus determines the values of events. And so it's the idea that the fondness of talk, or like, because God's anger and God's wrath comes up quite a bit, especially in the prophets. But again, going to the center of the book, God doesn't afflict from his heart. Like, that's not the primary thing that he does, according to the Book of Lamentations. Whatever, you know, how this judgment has come on, or how this pain, how this grief has come, like, it isn't as though this is the real thing God wants to give us. He wants to smite us and snuff us out. But it also acknowledges the complexity of the world where we're implicated, I guess, in evil. And it's like the idea, Miroslav Volf's book, Exclusion and Embrace, talks about, I think it's that book. But like, if God didn't judge the world, he wouldn't care. Like, if there wasn't some sort of consequences for evil, would it really be evil? Like, what would make it different from good? That moves into philosophy. That moves away from like, being pastoral. But again, I think the heart of this book is that God does not afflict from his heart. And the structure of the book, I know I've said it a number of times, but is that, yeah, your grief and your pain are legitimate and real to God, and he doesn't want to force you to just, you know, start at Y and Z and then you're done, and suppress it or move on, but take it for what it is as it moves to hope. Marty has her hand.
I remember hearing a really powerful sermon many, many years ago by a Dutchman who was at the time working at the Greek. And it was about, he talked about how, why in God's providence he chose a prophet like Jeremiah to be the one who preached judgment. Who was the one who preached judgment when the judgment actually came. Because prophet after prophet had reminded the people of Deuteronomy and covenant. You know, if you obey me, you'll be blessed to be in the land, but if you continue to follow after idols and sacrifice your children and do all this horrible stuff, I will have to judge you. And it was really powerful because he pointed out God chose a really sensitive prophet who experienced huge pain in giving this message of judgment because that reflected God's heart He didn't choose Jonah, for example, who was so disappointed when the people of Nineveh repented and did share God's joy that they repented. He chose Jeremiah, who just experienced extreme pain, depression, about having to give this message of judgment. And there's a place, I don't remember where it is, but the guy that gave this sermon, there's a place in Jeremiah where God is speaking and saying, I wish I could go away on vacation and not have to do this to you. I wish I didn't have to. I wish my justice didn't demand that that finally the judgment's going to come. And it was really helpful. I don't know if we have it on the recording or not, but it was just so helpful to think of.
Yeah.
God chose that kind of prophet because he actually reflected the pain that God experienced in finally, after giving the Israelites chance after chance after chance after chance,
Yeah. I mean, and maybe it's as good a time as any also to say, limitations is not like the final word in the Bible on grief or on suffering or on judgment. And there's an interesting... So Lamentations isn't really used much by New Testament authors. But one of the places where it is, I think, is quite interesting. So in the Gospel of Matthew, when Jesus is being crucified, Matthew writes, this is in Matthew 27, and the passers-by blasphemed him, wagging their heads. And Richard Hayes says that this language corresponds almost identically to a verse in Lamentations 2, all who pass by along the way clap their hands at you and hiss and wag their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem is the full. But sort of the way the verbs and the nouns work, it lines up really closely. And so he says that Matthew connects the crowd's mockery of Jesus back to the experience of judgment that the people felt in Lamentations. So what was direct? So the experience of judgment and mockery that the people felt in Lamentations 2, Matthew is evocatively echoing and saying, this is what Jesus took on himself. Like, this is, like, Jesus took this himself. He became, the subject, I guess, of this pain and this grief and humiliation. And he says, it subliminally suggests that the crucified Jesus paradoxically has become the embodiment of the scorned city of Jerusalem. He says a lot more stuff too, but so I think it's interesting even to see, yeah, again, like I said at the end, that is not the final word that the Bible has on grief or on pain. And I didn't want to just, I don't know, there's something about how the book ends with ambiguity, that I sort of wanted to end the lecture there too, because. But anyway, yeah. So, Marty,
do you think C.S. Lewis's book of Grief Observed? I've not read it for a long time. Do you think that's kind of in the spirit of?
I think if it's read not as a, I think if it's read, it's interesting if you read it. Dick pointed this out to me. If you read it as sort of a book on the problem of good and evil, that it's like against God, it's like, well, the answers to these problems he's bringing up, he's already answered in a book he published years before. But I think if you see it as an expression of grief, I would think it would be kind of similar. Yeah. I haven't read it in a number of years either. I should have read it for this. I came across a number of quotes from it, and it is brutal. But yeah, Danny?
In your study, can you kind of talk about your sense of dynamics between like individual and corporate in that? this isn't really like a question, but mm-hmm. just like a sentence thought that kind of Melissa's question kind of made me think of, like, I guess, the sense of like corporate shame, mm-hmm. which I feel like, I don't know if that's kind of like just the way the American church is now, or American, certain American churches are, but I feel like it's not something I've kind of experienced in a corporate setting. I mean, I think it's easier to kind of lament the culture and be like, the world is terrible, but then maybe be less like self-reflective as a church, and maybe how the church itself may be engaging in certain sins or propagating certain things or overlooking something. So, so yeah, that second part isn't really a question, but I guess just your sense of these different dynamics, because, yeah, I think in Lamentations it really seems like there's this corporate sense of shame and lament that perhaps maybe in ways different or overlap with kind of individual instances of, I guess, working through grief.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a really good question. I mean, I think, well, this is just apparent, like, or obvious, but, I mean, these are written in a really different culture that doesn't live on the other side of, like, modernity, and doesn't sort of see the individual as the primary sort of unit in society, and but sees identity, I think, more collectively. What's the Ubuntu phrase? There's no me without us. There's no me. Is that what it is? Something like that? Yeah, yeah. Which is, you know, an African. Oh, they did?
The Celtics
used it? Oh,
yeah.
What's his name?
2008 or whatever. They're like Ubuntu all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's cool. What's his name uses it? I can't remember his name. I can see his face right now. Desmond Tutu uses it, yeah. But I think there's just a more natural connection between a collective identity and an individual in the ancient world than there is for us. But that's a fairly obvious thing. I mean, it is interesting. I mean, the third poem with the man, it's his testimony. It moves from a report on the collective shame, the collective humiliation, and he's like, this is where I was in all of this. Like, this is my pain, this is my thing, which then I think allows him to move into giving his sermon of, this is why I have hope. Maybe you could have hope as well. But, yeah, I'm not sure what else to say, actually, to be honest. Do you have any other thoughts or any other?
No.
Yeah.
Because I just feel like the idea of what corporate means.
Yeah.
I mean, possibly, I can kind of understand in a liturgical sense, but just in terms of like a cultural sense. Like, I think there is certainly like in our society when like they're very like big events that happen, or people talk about like corporate greed or something. Like, there are things that people grieve in a collective mm-hmm. way, but often it's like, I feel like something like that's happening to people, or like some sort of like more abstract reality that's like apart from maybe things that people are actually doing themselves or contribute to.
Yeah, I mean, I think lament is a prayer. It's not just mourning, but it's mourning and protesting directed at God, believing God, whether or not he's going to do what you want to do, he can do something eventually. And so I think that makes it harder on a cultural level, but I do think there are instances of collective mourning, whether it's certain holidays, or, I mean, you just say September 11th, and it's a day that's associated with deep grief, and there's services, and there's, there's other things, and that's a good, Good. Do you have something to say to that?
Yeah, I heard Brian Stevenson say this a lot, that he says in our culture we do victory really well, but we don't do like shame or sorrow.
Yeah, or defeat.
Like, if you look at the songs, we have so many victory songs, but we don't have any like a lot of like sorrowful songs, is what he says. And so it's almost like lamentation. That's why I like the title as well. It's like, it kind of gives it a shape where, you know, if we wanted to, there's, it gives us kind of the words to say. Right. Some people would say like blues, but you know, that's
yeah.
He was saying like culturally, that's just kind of what we don't do well.
That just reminded me. Flannery O'Connor has, she says something, I think it's in Mystery and Men or somewhere, but she says the reason the South produces better writers than people in the North is because they live with a sense of failure, like that they lost something. She's talking about the Civil War. And she, I don't think, is someone who says, oh, all good art comes from pain. You need to have pain to, you know, be productive. I don't think that's her point, but you know, I do think, in especially in America, you know, I don't know if it's still the same in the South, you know, 40 years after she wrote that. But yeah, I think we live in a pretty unusual moment in history where we don't really have a lot of, as Americans, I mean, we now have the Iraq War, we have September 11th, we have Vietnam, but mostly we kind of have this story of victory and onward and upward and you know, that goes back to Manifest Destiny or whatever, or other things. But I think most other cultures have memories of being, I mean, my brother was a missionary in the Czech Republic for for 7 or 8 years. And I mean, talk about a people who, I mean, it's just sort of like they were taken over by someone else and then they were taken over by someone. It's just time after time again. And it's so foreign to me because it's like, well, all that stuff happened before you were born. Like, why do you hate, why are you angry with Russia? Like, or Russians, like, you weren't involved. That didn't, but it's still like a cultural, it's a collective, it's a part of what it means to be Czech, is to own some of those things. And that's very foreign to me, but, yeah, Sarah?
I was thinking that on an individual level, I wonder if part of what makes movement through grief difficult is the sense that if I come to the end, then I will have forgotten. To end grief means you're letting go of something, you're forgetting it, in part because there aren't collective opportunities like, what's the month you said, the month of Av?
Yeah, Tisha B'Av. Yeah,
where like the whole culture is holding memorial space, really. And so I wonder what, and what you're describing is so poignant, that, you know, even culturally, do we have ways of remembering together, remembering grief and failure and sorrow and loss, anywhere near the ways that we have for sort of celebrating strength or triumph. So yeah, I guess that that's been kind of kicking around for me as we discuss like the role of memory in grieving and in being able to come to kind of the end, maybe of an acute time of grief, but to know that to continue forward in my life is not to betray the memory of someone or an event that was really hurtful. Like, we don't just forgive and forget, you know, or but there's a way to remember well that continues to both validate whatever the experience was, but also to, I thought your language really interesting, like to not make it an identity, you know, but to know that this is part of who I am.
Yeah, that makes me just think of the lecture that Marta Crilly gave here last term, which was about memorial, public memorials. She's someone who works, she's an amazing person, and she was an archivist for the city of Boston, and it's on our podcast if anyone wants to download it and listen to it. It was quite a good talk on some of those things. But, does anyone else want to say anything? Well, thank you all for coming. God bless you, especially this side as you drive home. But thanks for coming. Have a good night.